It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
CDC chief claims real signs of progress in Ebola fight, and UN envoy to Syria says Kurds losing the ability to defend Kobani. I'm Bill Michaels reporting from Washington. The head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control says the fight against Ebola in Africa will be long and hard, but he says there are real signs of progress. At a media briefing Tuesday, Dr. Thomas Frieden said there are no new cases in Nigeria and the outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is contained. He also said there is a decrease in the number of new cases in parts of Liberia, one of the hardest hit countries.
This is an Ebola epidemic. It's the first Ebola epidemic the world has ever known. And we can still turn it around, but it is going to require very rapid action. Within countries, we need to ensure that anyone with symptoms that might be Ebola is rapidly isolated and cared for so that they can increase their chance of survival and reduce the chance that they will spread it to others.
You can read more about this story at voanews.com. The top United Nations official in South Sudan says peacekeepers are set to increase patrols outside their bases to protect civilians living in fighting zones. Nearly 100,000 displaced civilians have taken refuge at UN peacekeeping bases, while the rest are living outside of camps, often out of the reach of aid. The United Nations Special Envoy to Syria says Kurds defending the city of Kobani against the Islamic State are very close to no longer being able to fight off the militants. Stefan de Mistura said Tuesday the Kurds are using what he calls normal weapons against Islamic State tanks and mortars. This is VOA News. In Islamic State militants continue to terrorize Iraqi civilians, the United Nations warns it is struggling to cope with the humanitarian needs of nearly 2 million people displaced by violence in that country. Margaret Bashir has more from the UN.
The UN's deputy humanitarian coordinator in Iraq, Kevin Kennedy, said via a video link from Erbil that there needs to be a sustained international effort to address the growing humanitarian crisis.
While we understand that the world's attention is focused primarily on the very serious security situation in Iraq and the region, we believe that the humanitarian situation, which is the other side of the coin, deserves equal serious consideration and the full support of all who can lend a hand.
Kennedy said the UN and its partners are facing three major challenges: reaching those in need because they are spread among 1,500 locations in Iraq, some not under government control, a shortage of shelter, and the impending winter. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
President Hassan Rouhani has called for Iran's universities to admit more foreign students and lecturers, and he says the country should not be afraid when university professors and lecturers make comments that are different from what the ruling establishment promotes. In a televised speech from Tehran University Tuesday, marking the start of the academic year, the president dismissed fears that such a move would encourage espionage. He said the country has much to gain from increased international exposure. Hong Kong students and government officials say they have reached an agreement to begin formal talks on demands for political reform later this week. After meeting with student representatives Tuesday evening, Undersecretary of Constitutional Affairs Lau Kong Wah said talks with the territory's Chief Secretary Carrie Lam would begin Friday. He added that the meeting is to focus on constitutional issues. International microblogging platform Twitter has sued the U.S. Justice Department and the Federal Bureau of Investigation for the right to release more information about government surveillance of its users. The lawsuit was filed Tuesday in a Northern California court. Under current regulations, Twitter cannot reveal certain information about government requests for users' data relating to national security. And a federal appeals court has struck down a ban on same-sex marriages in the western states of Idaho and Nevada, a day after the country's highest court let stand a similar ruling in five other states. Reporting from Washington, I'm Bill Michaels, and this is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's president goes before the ICC today, Wednesday.
There has been no indication from the representative of the government of Kenya that they intend to adopt any of the measures which the prosecution has urged upon them and which in some cases the chamber has suggested they should adopt.
Benjamin Gumper is the ICC prosecution lawyer. UN peacekeepers in South Sudan are to extend patrols outside their base camps. Zimbabwe's finance minister says his country will stay with the US dollar. And a member of Liberia's legislature said President Sirleaf's request for more emergency constitutional powers is tantamount to military rule.
The manner and form in which the president is now proceeding is dangerous. And I want to be very clear that we will not allow the military junta to go on our country under a constitutional arrangement. We cannot do that today. We will not do that tomorrow.
Akaros Gray is an opposition member of the Liberian House of Representatives. Experts studied Nigeria's response to the Ebola outbreak. And a shooting a month ago near the Ethiopian embassy in Washington has sparked rival protests. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up at Daybreak Africa. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta will today, Wednesday, attend a hearing on his case at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, where he is facing five charges of crimes against humanity for allegedly helping organize the deadly 2007 post-election violence in Kenya. Mr. Kenyatta has pleaded not guilty to all charges. Lisa Bryan reports for VOA from Paris.
Yes, that's the end of this status conference today.
The first day of the status hearing at the International Criminal Court pretty much ended the way it began, with the prosecution claiming the Kenyan government was blocking access to key documents for its case against President Uhuru Kenyatta, and the defense arguing it was doing its best to comply. At the end of the two-hour hearing, prosecution lawyer Benjamin Gumpert summed up his frustrations.
There has been no indication from the representative of the government of Kenya that they intend to adopt any of the measures which the prosecution has urged upon them and which in some cases the chamber has suggested they should adopt to overcome what they say is the impossibility of providing any more material. And as long as that remains the case, then we are, I would respectfully submit, deadlocked.
Kenya's president faces five counts at the ICC for his alleged role in overseeing post-election violence in late 2007 and early 2008 that killed about 1,100 people and displaced more than 500,000. Mr. Kenyatta says he is innocent.
You are saying that the only update is provision of this material.
It is, and I'm trying to briefly describe to your honours what the material is. If you only want me to...
Very briefly, please.
Well, I shall.
Much of Tuesday's hearing was spent wading through bureaucratic details as the prosecution described unsuccessful efforts to get complete records of Mr. Kenyatta's bank statements, phone calls, and tax filings. It argues these documents will help prove Mr. Kenyatta's role in bankrolling and orchestrating the violence. But Kenya Attorney General Getu Migai says the prosecution's demands were sometimes impossible to meet.
We have come here today offering many alternatives, including requesting, like we have done before, for the prosecution to give us actionable information, material that can help us to access. Please give us that information. We will supply whatever you need within 72 hours.
The status conference aims to set a date for Mr. Kenyatta's trial, but the prosecution says its case is faltering, not just for lack of key documents, but because witnesses have been intimidated to change their story or pull out. The court has summoned Mr. Kenyatta to appear Wednesday, which will make him the first sitting president to appear before the ICC. He's temporarily handed power over to Deputy President William Ruto, who is also on trial at the ICC for alleged crimes against humanity, charges Ruto has denied. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has asked the national legislature to give her more emergency powers in yet another effort to prevent the further spread of the Ebola virus. Liberia is already under a state of emergency and a curfew. In a letter to the plenary of the House of Representatives and the Senate, Sirleaf asked for powers to suspend seven different articles under the Liberian Constitution, including the freedom of movement, speech, powers to confiscate private property, and elections. Akaros Gray is an opposition member of the House of Representatives. He says he intends to vote no to the president's request because he doesn't want to return Liberia to the days of military dictatorship.
In my view, this is dangerous, and it reminds all of the days when the dictators govern Liberia. Liberia cannot be governed by martial law. Why is it true that we have a state of emergency? The Liberian Constitution, under Article 87, is very clear that during the state of emergency, no provision of the Constitution can be suspended. The Constitution cannot be abrogated. The legislative branch of government, the judiciary branch of government cannot be dissolved. So, in my view, we cannot provide an absolute authority of such to the president. It would be draconian. And Liberia cannot be controlled by jackals. We cannot permit that to happen today, and we will not permit that to happen. I will publicly advocate against that, and I will vote against that.
But, Representative Gray, you do understand what the president is trying to get at, and that is Ebola has gotten out of control, and maybe this is another way that she can help the country control the spread of Ebola.
Authority under the state of emergency has been given to the president as far back as August 7 of this year. What has the president done with that authority given to her under the state of emergency is yet to be explained. So for the president to ask for absolute authority under the condition where the justice minister has just resigned, where the president now is asking for authority to compare people to work and provide certain services. So this could be a dangerous precedent to provide absolute authority to the president. While we support the fight against Ebola, and we encourage a massive battle against the Ebola fight, but at the same time, we cannot thwart the Constitution of the Republic of Liberia and provide absolute authority to one head of state. We cannot do that today. We must not do that tomorrow.
You already alluded to the midterm election, the special senatorial election. The president is suggesting that perhaps she needs power to decide whether the election should be suspended.
All right, Mr. Body, why is it true that we're in a crisis point in terms of the Ebola fight? And we may not go to elections this month of October 14th. But mind you also, there must be broader consultation of political parties, political leaders, the religious community and civil society organization, and the three branches of government, that is the judiciary, the executive, and the legislative branch of government. The National Elections Commission has written the legislative branch of government to find a way out. But to provide a single authority to the president to make a decision on when we have election, they stand among the chaos. Do we want chaos in Liberia? No, we don't want chaos. So we cannot and we must not provide that authority to the president. The manner and form in which the president is now proceeding is dangerous. And I want to be very clear that we will not allow the military junta to go on our country on a constitutional arrangement. We cannot do that today. We will not do that tomorrow.
Akaros Gray is a member of the House of the Liberian House of Representatives from the Opposition Congress for Democratic Change. You are speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. While the Ebola virus continues to take a heavy toll in Liberia and Sierra Leone, Nigeria is receiving praise for its swift control of the disease. There have been no new cases of the virus in the country since August 31st. As Jeff Swiker reports from Lagos, preparation and swift response by a well-organized public health system were critical to Nigeria's success.
We have been able to contain the Ebola virus disease, and we can confidently say that Nigeria is today Ebola-free.
2 months after Nigeria reported its first case of Ebola, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan declares his country Ebola-free. Medical experts from around the world are studying the success of the Nigerian response to see what they can learn. Nancy Knight with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is working with the Nigerian Emergency Operations Center in Lagos.
Nigeria's response in terms of the difference from other countries had to do with the speed at which they began their response by identifying the imported case and the establishment, the utilization of the incident management system with the establishment of an emergency operations center.
On July 20th, a Liberian-American en route from Monrovia collapsed inside the international airport in Lagos. 3 days later, Nigeria's first or index case of Ebola was confirmed. Dr. Faisal Schwab is the incident manager at the Nigerian Emergency Operations Center.
So even ahead of the detection of a case, we already had capacity building going on in the States. You know, we already had trainings and pre-position of supplies.
Health experts say the spread of Ebola to Lagos, a densely populated city of 18 million, was a potential catastrophe. Nigerian officials quickly sent out investigators to identify and isolate all contacts with the index case. The list of potential exposures grew to more than 800.
One thing that could easily have led to a worse scenario was if the contacts or if cases were in the communities and they're spreading the disease. But this was not the case in Nigeria because we were followed up the contacts as aggressively as possible.
Fever is one of the first symptoms of Ebola. Here at Murtala Muhammad International Airport in Lagos, travelers must fill out health forms declaring any contact with Ebola victims and have their temperature taken. Dr. Alex Oko is director of Port Health in Lagos.
For passengers who have symptoms suggestive of Ebola or who have a temperature above 38 degrees, they don't get to check in.
Community outreach is another critical part of incident management. These volunteers have visited 26,000 households, educating the public about how the virus is spread. Nigerian officials say they will continue screening passengers at ports of entry as long as Ebola is present in neighboring countries. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Lagos.
It's Wednesday morning, October 8th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 minutes past the hour. The top United Nations official in South Sudan says peacekeepers are set to increase patrols outside their bases to protect civilians living in fighting zones. VOA's East Africa correspondent Gabe Jarslow reports from Juba that reaching those displaced by violence remains a challenge for the UN.
Speaking at a news conference Tuesday, the head of the UN mission in South Sudan, Ellen Loy, said peacekeepers are planning to extend patrols outside of base camps to protect those affected by violence.
They even want them to move out of some of the UN camps to be visible in the communities and thereby give a sense, hopefully, of security.
About 1.5 million people have been displaced in South Sudan since December by fighting between the government and an armed opposition stemming from a political dispute between the president and his former deputy. Nearly 100,000 displaced civilians have taken refuge at UN peacekeeping bases, while the rest are living outside of camps, often out of the reach of aid. The United Nations has about 10,500 peacekeepers in South Sudan and received a surge of forces this year from Ethiopia, Rwanda, and Ghana. Loy says the UN is expecting more to come, including a battalion from China, but said they are having a little difficulty getting troops and equipment in place. Access is another obstacle, as military forces have in some instances prevented UN peacekeepers from moving in conflict areas. Loy called for greater support from South Sudan authorities.
The challenges in South Sudan are enormous. These challenges are both internal and external. And for the mission to implement our mandate, we require cooperation and support by all parties in South Sudan, the government, the opposition, and other interest groups.
In May, the UN Security Council adjusted the mandate for peacekeepers in South Sudan to give priority to protecting civilians. President Salva Kiir has been critical of the new mandate, complaining last month at the UN General Assembly that the mission had stopped helping with development and capacity building. Gabe Jocelyn, VOA News, Juba.
Zimbabwe Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa says his country is sticking with the U.S. dollar until the economic situation improves. He is in Washington this week for the annual World Bank International Monetary Fund meetings. Mr. Chinamasa dispels what he calls the misconception that most African countries, including the cash-strapped Zimbabwe, bring begging bowls to the Bretton Woods institutions when they come for these meetings.
We are not going to see any return of the Zim dollar anytime soon, primarily because the circumstances don't warrant the return of the local currency. The reason why we had to introduce, and I personally was the acting Minister of Finance when I introduced the multi-currency regime, was basically to address the issue of confidence, of trust. Now, we need to restore confidence in our country in the manner that we run and we manage our economy. We need to get the macroeconomic fundamentals right before we can decide to bring back the Zim dollar. It's very important also that the country should get out of sanctions. If we have sanctions lifted against us, primarily by the European Union and the Americans, that will make Zimbabwe a more normal country in terms of its trading, in terms of how it relates to other countries, and it also removes the stigma which is against Zimbabwe. But more than anything else, we need to produce and produce and produce for export. And is when we reach a level of production in agriculture, in manufacturing, in tourism, in mining, then we can start talking about bringing the Zim dollar. Not now.
But also there's been a lot of criticism about some of the policies in Zimbabwe that are not conducive for investors.
I think it's important maybe to spell out what those policies are so that I can be more specific and say, you are right or you are wrong, and where we think we are wrong, which policies we are addressing. I think you need to spell them out.
I think one of the grey areas has really been the indigenization bill, where
foreigners,
51%.
That is an issue that basically we are addressing. Mm. And it's only a question of clarifying what the law is. And the law basically acknowledges that there is no one-size-fits-all. In other words, exploitation of minerals is not the same way as you coming with your money to set up your factory. In the case of exploitation of minerals, basically what we are saying is the mineral is ours, and you are bringing your capital, you are bringing your technology, you are bringing your managerial skills, and we then say, let's team up. That basically in the mining sector. But in the financial services sector or in manufacturing, we are not saying at all that when you bring your money, 51% is ours. We are not saying that. And shortly, it's a matter that is under consideration. The Minister of Youth, Indigenization, Comrade Nema, is going to clarify for us all so that we can all sing from the same hymn book.
Zimbabwe's Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa was speaking in Washington with Marvelous Nyangwe of VOA's Zimbabwe service. There is more fallout from a shooting last month near the Ethiopian embassy in Washington that resulted in the embassy's security attaché being sent home. The incident sparked rival protests on Tuesday near the U.S. State Department, with one group urging the United States to do more to protect the embassy. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has the story.
As they waved banners and the Ethiopian flag, about 20 protesters calling themselves Ethiopians for Peace called for more security at the Ethiopian embassy in Washington. Mulu Asafa said an incident which resulted in an embassy staffer firing shots at protesters never should have happened.
We felt like we've been violated. We've been let down by Secret Service. You know, they should have protected the embassy.
He said his group is not against protests, but feels that demonstrators should not be allowed, in his words, to occupy embassy grounds.
Literally, there was a fight. They just took out the Ethiopian flag and they was trying to replace.
As he spoke, about 15 people who were part of that embassy confrontation held a counter demonstration across the street. Elizabeth Alte said they had a warning for the United States concerning the TPLF, the main branch of the Ethiopian government's ruling party.
I'm protesting to tell America and American people, TPLF, terrorist group, take over become a government still terrorizing East Africa.
The two sides were separated by police barricades as they voiced their opposing views. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with netball. Uganda's netball team, the She Cranes, were crowned the Nile Special Uganda Sports Press Association USPA sports team for September. USPA bestowed the accolade on the She Cranes during their monthly meeting in Kampala on Monday in recognition of their qualifying for the 2015 Netball World Cup in Gaborone, Botswana last month. Uganda topped the table in the round-robin contest, which also featured Namibia, Swaziland, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and hosts Botswana. Uganda and runners-up Zambia earned the tickets to the World Cup due in Sydney, Australia. The She Cranes last competed at the World Cup in 1979 in Trinidad and Tobago. Zambia are World Cup debutants. Uganda and Zambia join Malawi and South Africa in presenting Africa's challenge for glory on the world stage. Turning to football, seven countries presented their bids to stage the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, Secretary General Hicham El Amrani disclosed in Cairo, Egypt on Tuesday. The bids, which were submitted to CAF before the 30th September deadline, were from Algeria, Egypt, Gabon, Ghana, Kenya, Sudan, and Zimbabwe. CAF reopened the bidding process on the 23rd of August after Libya withdrew from staging the event owing to insecurity in the country. Amrani says CAF will named a successful bid sometime next year. In Somalia, the domestic club league has been expanded from 8 to 10 teams, the Somali Football Federation president Abdikwani Said revealed in Mogadishu. Said says this is a significant development in Somali football, which contributes towards offering a better future for the youth of the country. Finally, Dutchman Nico Laboham is the new assistant coach for Zambia's national team Chipolopolo. The Football Association of Zambia president Kalusha Bwale revealed in Lusaka on Tuesday. He's expected to beef up the former African champions' technical bench, headed by Zambian owner Janza. Zambia have struggled so far in their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers, playing to a scoreless draw against Mozambique at home and going down 2-1 away in Cape Verde Islands. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control says the fight against Ebola in Africa will be long and hard, but he says there are real signs of progress. At a media briefing on Tuesday, Dr. Thomas Frieden said this includes better training, more understanding of the virus, and safer practices, including during burials for Ebola victims. Frieden said there are no new cases in Nigeria and that the outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is contained. Meanwhile, the Liberian man diagnosed with Ebola in the southwestern U.S. city of Dallas, Texas, is still in critical condition after taking an experimental drug. Frieden says that none of the 48 people being monitored after direct or indirect contact with Thomas Eric Duncan is sick. Somalia's first ever cash withdrawal machine has been installed in the capital, Mogadishu. The Mogadishu-based Salama Somali Bank installed the machine in a hotel used by diaspora foreigners and government officials. Bank official Mualim Abukar told VOA Somali Service the machine will allow customers to withdraw money from their foreign accounts. Abukar said that the installation of the ATM was a big step forward and it represents the growth and strength of Mogadishu's business community. Somalia has a rudimentary banking sector with many people relying on remittances from abroad. That's it for this Wednesday, October 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Jimmy Koch, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the dry lands of Africa, where poverty and the environment intersect. 60% of sub-Saharan Africa is classified as arid, semi-arid, or sub-humid. Poor soil and drought in the Horn of Africa and the Sahel are annual concerns. That's next time on VOA Africa.
VOA. Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.